In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp.
Josh, how are you doing this evening?
Happy Mother's Day, Jim.
Yes, happy Mother's Day to all of the listeners that are out there. Appreciate the time. I know everybody's a little busy.
To the biggest mother I know.
Yeah. Exactly. So tonight's a little bit of a these episodes here when we talk about different things, because we can kind of talk about one, move on a little bit, you know, anything else that might come up, you know what I mean? Which is always nice. I do want to mention, of course, that this episode is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit EMSManager.net for a free copy of their innovative and easy to use EMS employee scheduling and management software. Of course, guys, you want to follow us on Twitter. You can follow us at EMS Safe is a Twitter handle, and make comments about what you're hearing during the show, so we can see what you have to say there. We'll try to maybe mention some of the tweets as well as we go along here. So we'll give that a shot also, just to get some more interaction, you know, for the show itself. I do also want to mention, guys, the ProMed Network and the other podcasters that are out there with us, you know, they have some great content on those shows. So if you're listening to us and you want to listen to some other EMS podcasts that are out there, one of the other ones that I would recommend is the Medicast. It's at medicast.com/blog. And my friend Jamie Davis does a great podcast there. Some of the more recent ones he has talk about all hazards planning, and things like aging pedestrians being at greater risk being struck by a car and more likely to die in traffic accidents. So go check out Jamie's podcast there and some of the stuff he has there. Great content. And as always, if you do, be sure to tell him that Jim and Josh sent you. I see Festivitz in the chat room says he wants them speaking tonight, and of course it's me, Jim Hoffman, and Josh Knapp is with me as always.
I am. I'm flying a little blind. I'm having some computer problems, which we have encountered in the past in various ways, and the gremlins. The gremlins are visiting me, so I'm flying blind right now. I'm going to try to get into the chat room as soon as my computer decides that it's going to cooperate.
Gotcha. Sounds good. Sounds like a plan. Well, Josh, one of the subjects which kind of, I guess, relates to you a little bit, when we talk about oxygen in EMS and the change in thinking that's been going on, where everybody used to get, you know, NAMI breather, 15 liters per minute, didn't matter what kind of history they had or anything like that.
Well, you know the thinking behind that. There was no empirical evidence. There was no science. It was just like, it can't hurt you. And,
right.
You know, more oxygen is...
more air.
Right, more air.
And I came across a recent article in EMS World, which was... done by Kelly Grayson, who's done a couple of presentations with me, one over at the EMS Web Summit. And he's also and William Gandy, William Jean Gandy. And they talk about, you know, more oxygen, and really great article on EMS World there, guys. Go check it out. I'll put a link to it, of course, in the show notes. I'll actually put it even in the chat room. For any people in the chat room want to take a look at it, they can. But this, it's a little long to read as we're talking about it right now, because it's about a 4-page article. But, you know, I like the article a lot, Josh, because they break it down into different types of patients and talk about the role of oxygen in each one of those patients and the misconception. You know, one of them is the chest pain, you know, chest pain patients where, you know, the more oxygen is better. You got to give oxygen to those heart cells. And then, you know, but then, of course, the flip side of that is they talk about how it's not necessarily the best thing to do because it can inhibit natural equilibrium doing what it has to do. It can inhibit, the way the gases inside the body react to each other. Something even they quote about how it can wash out trying to think of the gas now. Can't think of it.
The nitrogen?
Right. Washes that out, you know. So all these types of things that they talk about, and they give a little scenario about a patient, chest pain patient that they had, and they did good, and the patient went to the cath lab and everything, and the doc asked, you know, why did you put him on such high concentration oxygen, you know, and they reference a book from 2000 or whatever that they did it for. So I think it's important for our listeners who are engaged in these types of, you know, conversations here, to sort of read these articles. And I like the reason I like this article because it's very, it's 4 pages, but it's broken down to common cold types that we get, and really quickly goes over the reasons why so much oxygen, you know, isn't all that great. You know, I think we have a caller, Josh. That's all right. We'll just get a caller in here real quick.
Sure. Bring him in.
Let's see who we got here. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Tim. How you doing?
Okay. How are you?
All right. I don't know if you read the article or not, Tim, or I'm sure you read some articles regarding the dangers of giving too much oxygen to various types of patients, you know, chest pain, stroke, COPD, even things like post-arrest patients, and how giving that too much oxygen is, you know, not necessarily as good as everyone has been pushing for how many years now, you know, 10 years, 15 years, you know, pushing that thought process, you know. Yeah, and I'm kind of glad that some of this research is being done, and some of these the point that they make in this particular article, you know, that we're talking about how, you know, it's not necessarily that great, you know. I'm sure you've
one
done
of the papers I like. Yeah, one of the papers I like to refer to is from 1950, where they took some patients who had heart attacks. They were not currently having a heart attack, and they randomized them to either medical air or 100% oxygen.
Right.
Now, whatever you're getting by mass, it's not 100%, but that was in the title.
I gotcha. I think, Tim, you're cutting out a little bit.
They found that putting on a treadmill for a second, pretty much more stimulation with the high oxygen than with the room air. And it was a small study, and it wasn't anything definitive, but we were routinely using high-flow oxygen back then, and it was something that people haven't really followed up on. And even in the 1990s, there was a study by Dr. Wayne on trauma patients who came in on high-flow oxygen versus those who had less oxygen, and the high-flow oxygen patients did worse.
Now,
nobody
do you think?
follows up on this stuff for very few.
Yeah. I mean, you too, Josh. I mean, the both of you guys. Do you think that there's the reason why we just haven't sort of followed up on not giving as much, just because it's the same thing. A lot of other things that we do, just because it's the way it's been done, and people are just so resistant to do away with it.
I think that it's laziness. I think I'll probably please Tim with that comment, but it really truly, you know, when you get this new research out and it's substantial, it's substantiated, it has backup to it, and we don't, it's just like longboards, you know, spinal immobilization. Who's doing that? Who's actually just clearing people in the field? Who's actively doing that? And you'll find it's a small percentage of the systems out there. And why? Because most of the medical control probably just doesn't bother with the research, doesn't bother looking into it, doesn't bother saying, hey.
Hey, you broke up there, Josh, a little bit.
Yeah, I'm hearing myself. I'm in computer hell right now.
I hear you.
So,
well, it's funny. I mean, you know, I'm actually guilty of that too. I mean, listen, early on, I never read any of that, you know, that research. You know, like Tim's talking about, it's so old that, you know, it sort of points to the fact that too much is no good. And I remember working with partners who would put patients on nasal cannulas who were having chest pain, and I would be like, "Oh my God, what are you doing?" You know, it's well, their sat is whatever, and you know, so then I put him on a high concentration because they were already satting at 97%. And
well, it's buying into the dogma, Jim.
Yeah,
it's
and
buying,
I did.
And
I'm guilty.
We're all guilty. Hey, you know, we're all guilty from the ideal that, well, you know what? It's a little bit of oxygen. It won't hurt them. And now they're coming out with, you know, definitive analytical results that say, no, indeed, too much oxygen does hurt you. You know, and, you know, I'm a big one, and, you know, Tim and I have crossed paths on this, on the cooling studies, but I think that the evidence is out there that, you know, post-cardiac arrest cooling is a big step forward in preserving brain function, and in the end, that's what you need. I mean, preserving heart function is one thing, Jim, but if you're, you know, raising a vegetable patch, what's the point? And now there's this, you know, new evidence that says, hey, if you do these steps, you're going to preserve the whole person. So why aren't we doing this? If we're doing these steps, because in some cases, like spinal immobilization, they're not coming out definitively and saying it's causing more harm. You know, in some cases they are, but not definitively across the scope. And until somebody actually successfully sues and says, why did you immobilize that person? You caused them more harm than if you just left them alone. I don't think we're going to get wide adoption because it's, hey, you know, it won't hurt anything. You know, what harm will it cause? And that's the way we tend to look at, you know, our jobs. Well, let's do it because what harm will it cause?
That's not true.
You don't think so?
There has been wide adoption of spinal clearance, and just because some places do not do spinal clearance does not mean that it's going to take a lawsuit or something. Connecticut is eliminating backboards. They're only going to be using for extrication and for movement. And that's mm-hmm. not movement in the ambulance, but for carrying somebody someplace.
Mm.
I don't think that, you know,
they're
I think
be
that you
the
could
first
point
state that
look,
shows
you,
they're
you
going
can
to show the rest
point
of us
to
that it can
some
be done.
Systems, you can absolutely point to some systems that are thinking forward and adopting these new advances in science, thinking more empirically and acting on protocols more empirically based on evidence. But Tim, you know what? Across the country, we're doing something one way, and in a few areas,
no, we do it many different ways.
Well, we do it many different ways.
We do it many different ways. Just because what you see in New York in your one small section of the world is one way, and you think that everybody else is doing it one way, does not mean that that is.
No, it's not that at all. It's that I see it in the journals, I see it in the systems that I talk to other people, and it's not that way. And one small area, you know, Tim, listen, I don't put down Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania or wherever the hell that you work. I suggest you don't put down New York. Okay, it's one of the busiest systems in the country. And just because we may do something one way, you're from fucking Yonkers.
No, I'm from New York City. And
you work
what's
in
it got
Yonkers,
to do with anything?
Man.
New York,
but what does
compared
it have
to the rest
do with
of the
anything?
Country,
why you,
is a tiny
you're the one who brought up New York. You want to start a fight with me? God, you know.
Because it's a
bring
tiny
it
place. Of, hey, because
it's a
tiny
place
as far as the whole country is concerned. The whole population is about 300 million. New York's got 8 or 9 million. Tiny.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Now, Tim, but
Tim,
I mean, do
it. You are insignificant.
But, Tim, don't you think that still, I mean, I know you're saying Connecticut, looking, you know, they're going to be doing away with all the backboards and all, but I think still nationwide, so many places are really just clinging to not getting rid of them.
Well,
you know,
are we talking about eliminating backboards, or are we talking about spinal clearance, or are we talking about immobilizing everybody based on mechanism, or what kind of, you know, there are many different ways of doing it, which is the point I was trying to make to Josh when he got offended about the size of New York City.
Wait a second. Hold it. You know what? Let's talk about that there are many different ways of doing it, because I completely agree, and it runs down to the root, Tim, that EMS is completely fractured across this country. Would you agree with that?
Yes, that we agree on.
And you know, the thing that always boggles my mind is I don't care if it's in New York or a small town, Ohio. Okay, I don't care where it happens. If you have good empirical evidence that something that you're doing is either causing harm or has no benefit and potentially can cause harm, why the hell isn't it something that we share across the country? Where is the engine that will promote that better behavior, that better science?
Well, it's published in the journals.
But that's, you know, but yeah, it's published in the journals, but why doesn't it get taken up?
It requires literate people.
But, you know, I mean, Tim,
you know, what do we read in EMS? In EMS, we read GEMS, we read EMS One, we read EMS World. We don't read the original journals. We get the stuff read by people and then explain to us. We don't read the original literature. Very few people in EMS will actually read pre-hospital emergency care or Annals of Emergency Medicine or the American Journal of Emergency Medicine or the Journal of Emergency Medicine or pre-hospital disaster medicine or any of the journals out there that are relevant to what we do.
That's true. And you know, unfortunately, Tim, is, you know, some people aren't able to. I mean, based on just their education and what? No, I mean, just,
it is difficult.
You know, you can read
it's expensive to get access unless you have it through an employer. And one of the journals I really like is Academic Emergency Medicine, because everything that's more than 12 months old or 14 months old, they make freely available on their website. Annals of Emergency Medicine makes a few articles each month available for free.
You misunderstood me, Tim. I wasn't saying that – yeah, access is definitely something I think that many people have issues with. And I think that there are always ways to skin that cat and get around that for a lot of people. So that would even cut down, you know, the barrier to access for even more. But I think that there's an educational – component as well, because, you know, we sit there and we train people to do a task without really giving a good effort to the science behind that task.
Well, we do a very poor job of educating people about how to understand the way science works. We
right.
should start out EMS classes with an explanation of where the evidence is, what shows what works, what is questionable, which is almost everything, and what has been shown to be harmful, and how to read and understand a journal, not without needing to know all the statistical stuff, but a brief part on statistics, but not so that everybody can go and do all their calculations themselves. That's not the important part. It's about recognizing what biases the author is not controlling for, what variables the author is not controlling for, and recognizing them.
So having a discriminating eye when reading a scientific journal or a scientific article.
Yes.
And you know, what we train, what we teach is, you know, and a lot of times we don't even treat, you know, a lot of times the barrier to that, you know, to even the person who's interested is that educational component. They don't even have the vocabulary to be able to speak in terms of, you know, some of the more advanced areas of science. I mean, you know, granted, keep in mind, you know, most of the people who write these articles are doctors in their own right, and doctors are, you know, MD is an advanced degree. You know, it's beyond the even the master's
doctors
level.
Usually, doctors only recently started having training, education on research. They
right.
generally do not understand research if they were trained before maybe 10 years
ago.
Well,
I'm not even talking.
Was not one of the courses included in medical school.
You know, I agree
so
with that.
So there's still a lot of trouble getting the old-time doctors to understand stuff, and I found that it's a lot easier to get the younger doctors to read the research, to understand the research, and to make changes based on the research.
I think the requirements now in medical education are one that you need to be able to research things and understand things. I think there were fewer requirements back in the day for doctors to have to go through that level. I mean, you know, through that task. We're always faced, Tim, with the idea of what do you call the guy who graduated in bottom of his class? You know, what I'm talking about is a little bit more of keep in mind, and where I was sort of round robin getting to it, but keep in mind the educational component. An MD, regardless of how good they are or their exact training, they have that upper level, that tertiary level of college education. We have a standard
in EMS. But that doesn't always help. You know, if you if you look at the anti-vaccine people, a lot of them are doctors. You know, they've got a PhD and whatever. And these are people who have spent a ton of time in school. And they should be able to understand this stuff, but they are so biased that they don't understand it. And that is completely different from somebody who has a basic understanding of research. They don't have it.
I agree.
They do
I agree.
Not accept their biases.
Stand back a second. Stand back and just readjust your filter to a little greater granularity, okay? Because I understand that even people in the field with the education don't have the specific understanding or training to be able to dive into the research and understand what the research is telling them. I understand that. But if you step back and you say, let's just filter on the basis of education, period, and say, do you think somebody with a high school education is going to be able to look into that research and determine, you know, with the same frequency understand the results, or do you think somebody with a college education has a better shot at it? And that's sort of where I'm going with this, because our standards of education in EMS tend to be the lowest level as an entry point. And I think that that's something that we really need to look at within EMS to say, hey, you know, there's a lot of research coming out, but if you're not capable of even reading it, if you're not even capable of understanding that research means advancement in science, then we have bigger problems. We have bigger fish to fry.
You know, Josh, the problem I think with that too is also a fact that a lot of people in EMS, they're not motivated to read all the research. They're plenty happy to just follow the protocols and not concern themselves. Like even with this oxygen we're talking about, most protocols are still pushing high concentration oxygen as opposed to, you know, things like titrating it, you know, to the effect of whatever patient that we're having. And I think the same thing goes for the immobilization as well. I mean, you know, it's not something that should be all or nothing. It should be left up to providers to make judgments, you know, according to their assessments and patient presentations and things like that, and not just fall into some sort of cookie cutter, you know, protocol.
Should we be using a treatment for patients that has never been demonstrated to be safe or effective?
No,
spinal immobilization has never been demonstrated to be either one. And
right,
if we have such a low level of education in EMS, should we be trusting EMTs, medics, to make those decisions?
Well, that's
that's a great point.
That's a big part of the problem too, which is why I think at the same time we can kind of go back and forth and say, well, that's why everything is so protocol based, because there is that lack of trust. You know, the lack of education.
Well,
so let's just go ahead and give A, B, C, D, and this is what you do for the patient to have an MVA. And, you know, yeah, there's no research or benefit or that shows that mobilization is doing anything, but, you know, this is what we're going to do. This is the way we've been doing it, and we're going to keep doing it until something is proven otherwise. You know, and the same
you
thing
look
for
at
the
some
office.
Of the Facebook conversations on spinal immobilization, and people say, I'm going to do what's safe, I'm going to immobilize.
Right.
And it's never been shown to be
that,
safe.
Though.
There is no reason to believe that spinal immobilization is safe. The other thing they'll say is, I don't know enough to make a decision about this. Well, if you don't know enough to make a decision about it, you don't know enough to make a comment on it either.
Well,
and
I can also say
then you have the people
CYA,
who say,
CYA, that's what they're always...
Yes,
that's the
I'm going to do this to avoid getting in trouble because somehow... harming a patient by immobilizing them and taking their vertebral fracture and completing the fracture, somehow that's going to avoid getting in trouble.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, even in my small backwater town, I have issues with some people who seem to want to ignore the AHA guidelines on oxygen and, you know, cardiac care. And, you know, well, you know what? It's not going to hurt them, so let's put it on. And, you know, you got to step back, and it's like, but we're being educated. You know, the standards have changed. You know, there's the evidence is out there. The information
is out there. We've adopted so many things without evidence. Yeah, too much of what we've adopted has not had any evidence behind it.
But what do you do when there
think
is even?
Because the
when there's evidence and people are still refusing to follow that.
No. I'm talking about the adoption of oxygen. There was no evidence that using oxygen for a heart attack improved outcomes. No evidence that more people have survived because they got a lot of oxygen.
Right.
All
I,
we
no,
should
I
be
agree
doing
with that.
Is trying to maintain an oxygen saturation of 94% or above or whatever for patients who are used to living at a lower oxygen level, such as COPD patients.
Mm-hmm.
And
but
There is no reason to be providing a drug, and oxygen is a drug, to raise their oxygen saturation above that.
I agree. You're talking about even when there was no empirical evidence that said that it's a benefit. What I'm saying is there's actually evidence that says it's not a benefit, and in fact it's contraindicated. And the protocols in, you know, nationwide from the American Heart Association, which most systems base their individual protocols on, have changed. Yet the providers in the field turn around and choose to ignore those changes and say, well, this is the way I've always done it, therefore I'm going to continue.
Well, Josh, think of it this way, yeah. too. Remember being – when you went to EMT school, paramedic school, and they got to the COPD patient. They talk about, oh, too much oxygen is no good for these patients. But, you know, give it anyway because it's only a short transport to the hospital.
Uh-huh.
And you never – and you're always in the back of your head. You're like, oh, my God, this is not good. They told me this isn't good for the patient. Why am I giving it to them, you know? And it's just instead of following the complete thought about how, you know, it doesn't help them, it's like just give it anyway because, you know, you're not that far from the hospital and the length of time that they're on, it's not going to really make that much of a difference.
I think it's the do something syndrome, Jim.
Well, yeah.
We've talked about that before. I think
the board and collar is a big part of that, too. It's also a do something type thing.
Absolutely.
You get to the scene, there's a car accident, and, you know, oh, my God, it looks so horrible. I got to do something. I can't just walk into the ambulance and take him to the hospital. I got to make a big production and put him on a board.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that we're
and
faced with that.
The people who have trouble with following the Heart Association guidelines, they'll ignore that, but they say, oh, I can't do certain treatments or avoid doing certain things because I'd be violating protocol. I can't violate protocol, yet they'll go ahead and violate it. In Pennsylvania, statewide, we have spinal clearance protocols for a couple of years at least now, and people refuse to use them because
we have those.
I want to be safe.
We have those in New York, and where did they give us when they rolled out those protocols? Who did they say was using those protocols before us? I remember Canadian protocols being shown to us, and I'm trying to remember who else.
Maine.
Right.
They're the big ones. They've been using spinal clearance for 20 or 30 years now.
Right. And so we were shown, hey, you know what? These systems have used it. Here are the statistics behind it. We're finding that it's really not required. And now we even have a spinal clearance. You know, I had to go through an in-service on how to clear your spine. All right? And I went through that and got all that. I have yet to see anybody apply that in the field. It makes me it makes me nuts. Why should I stop?
When I talk with people about this, there are two different attitudes. One is, I don't think that's what the protocol means, and it's explicit. It says unless they have midline tenderness or they're confused or intoxicated or have paresthesias, you should not immobilize them. But try getting people to understand that. They're like, no, that's not what it means. They believe that spinal immobilization is something sacred that cannot be removed by protocol, that we have to do it. Yet, a little bit down the street from where I am, one of the services, they basically don't immobilize anyone because the emergency physicians realize it's a problem. Technically, not protocol, but you know, they're not going to start yelling at them and creating liability for themselves.
And you know, that's an excellent point because the problem isn't just in the field. I mean, if you are an enlightened medic and you have gone through and educated yourself and done the training and now you clear somebody spinally and you bring them in and the MD that you're bringing them to or the nurse, the triage nurse that you're bringing them to has not, you know, advanced themselves and are still in the old way, guess what? You're screwed because they look at you like, why didn't you? Well, not
gives
entirely
me an opportunity to educate them. Do you think I don't take advantage of that? I look for those opportunities.
I should know
they
who
must
I'm
cringe
talking to by now. Know what I'm talking about. But Tim, honestly, you know, I'm sure that within your system for the physicians and nurses that you know, there is some respect. But I occasionally I'm sure that you also come across a physician or a nurse you don't know. And I'll bet you when you go and try to educate them. And I'll bet you when you come try to educate them, you get a percentage of them who look at you like, who the fuck is this guy? He's an ambulance driver.
They do that
What's
already.
He trying to tell me? Well, they do. Yeah, well, that's just course for our job. But I'm saying, you know what I'm saying here. I mean, there's even when you have that teachable moment, there is going to be a barrier to that teachable moment because they're not even going to be open or receptive because you're below them.
Well,
and we deal with this
every
day.
Some people will listen. And I used to have this. I worked in a county before we had the statewide protocols where this county insisted that Lasix be given before nitro. And I didn't realize it because it was so obvious to me. It was at least a decade before I moved to me that I had been giving nitro first. And they were so far behind everybody else around them that I was automatically giving nitro and just ignoring the Lasix. And I'd get to the hospital and be like, oh, why'd you give nitro? They don't have chest pain. You didn't tell us they have chest pain. I'd say, I gave it because they have CHF. And same thing we'd go through over and over. I'd talk to the doctors. Doctors say, yeah, we understand where you're coming from. Problem is, they don't understand and they won't learn.
Right.
Somebody, and the county was very progressive on pain management. So it wasn't as if it was, and they were possibly the most progressive in the state on pain management. So it wasn't as if they were an entirely backward county. I think it's, you know, like doctors, medics, everything else. You find they are good in one area, not so good in another area, and really bad in some other areas.
And
so,
that's what we
you know,
have.
You try to educate them.
And that's what we have in terms of just moving our entire profession forward, because we're not just it's not just medics. It's the medics. It's the physician. It's the medical control that we operate under, and it's the hospitals that we interface with. And you know, everybody has to be on board for these advances to take hold. And I think that that's one of and adding to that all the fractures that we look at all the time.
But
right, listen, guys,
the best
real quick
way to get around that is to educate people on how to interpret research. Then you can get them to read it for themselves and understand what's going on. If you can do that, if you can show people that they can prove it to themselves, then that's when they learn.
I want to give it over to Jim for a second, but I have another thing right after our
I just want to quickly talk about EMS Manager for a second. But while I'm doing that, I mean, you guys can maybe think about this while I'm reading the sponsor message. I mean, I wonder if there's a way we can present the research to people that they be able to absorb it and not find it, I guess, cumbersome and not find it so, you know, tedious as a lot of research can be. So I guess maybe think about that for a minute. But as I've mentioned before, we are sponsored by EMS Manager. Go try out their software for yourself, guys. It takes the chore of employee scheduling and management of EMS providers and makes it easy to set up and easy to maintain and manage. You know, they've got a mobile web app. You can get the software from any smartphone and any mobile device, and it's much, much easy to use web interface than you might think. So, again, you can see it anywhere you have an internet connection, and managers and staff can both use it. You know, pricing is based on the size of the organization, so it's always affordable, and because it's web-based, your employee scheduling and software is located in the cloud, and of course, that means that there's no IT costs that you have to worry about. Okay, keep in mind, training is always free. The tech support is free. The system of software updates are always free. So if you're thinking about getting some sort of an employee scheduling software or management software, go check it out for yourself. It's emsmanager.net. I want to thank them for sponsoring EMS Office Hours as well as a lot of the other EMS programs from the ProMed Network. They are proud to support EMS providers and EMS managers through this sponsorship. So show your support for them in return. Go check out their free trial. It's customizable. You can get it over at emsmanager.net. It's from a LabTech, and it's for online employee scheduling and workforce management. Again, emsmanager.net. And, of course, if you do go and check it out. Be sure to send them that. Tell them that Jim and Josh sent you over there.
Absolutely. So I have a question, and this sort of leads into, you know, from it. It leads from what we were talking before about how can we get people to listen to the research, and I'm sort of thinking that, you know, is there anything that we can do to sort of raise our capital within the medical system? And then, you know, my eye gets drawn to a recent article. I don't know if you saw it, Jim. The one of the guys who was at the Texas fertilizer plant explosion, he claims to be one of the first medics on scene.
Uh-huh.
He got arrested for having bomb-making materials.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's the headline that comes out of that? It's not that he gets arrested for bomb-making materials or, you know, it's a separate type of thing. It's, you know, a medic responded to fertilizer, Texas disaster, making bombs.
Right.
Well, I mean, there are some people who have that hero complex where they need to be the one to rescue something, and then they will create an emergency so that they will have the opportunity to be the first one there and rescue people, even though it's a psychopathic attitude towards things.
You know, Tim,
it's rare, fortunately, but it is.
Well, but
it does exist. I don't know if that's related to this.
No. That's an excellent example, because the way that you sort of came right off of that is to say, well, guilt by association, which is the way the article was written. However, when you read through the details and the facts, one incident had nothing to do with the other. The guy was a responder. He was a decorated responder within his community. He was one of the first guys to be there, function on scene in a proper EMS manner. He happened to have had, and there's still not enough information about it, but let's call it a hobby, for lack of a better term. I mean, you know, you can get me in the chat room if you don't like that one. But he was making bombs at home, okay? One had nothing to do with the other, and that was one of the things that came out clearly in this article. However, the headline was written in such a way as to promote that idea that here's a first responder and he's actually causing the problem. And I'm like, how do we extrapolate? How do we extract ourselves from that, you know, first to blame scenario that we seem to always be in? You know, an ambulance gets into an accident, it must be the operator's fault. I mean, you know,
considered as guilty until proven innocent when we're driving lights on. That is something that should be taken for granted. When anybody who's doing anything that is high risk,
you want to
suspend them from that activity anytime something goes wrong until you can clear them.
So wait a second. So you have a patient, high-risk patient, you're transporting, you picked up, they have an MI, an arrest, and they die on you. Should you be called to account for their death from the get-go, or should maybe it
completely irrelevant?
So, but you're operating.
Do you have a reason for suggesting that the death of the because of what the medic did?
So, what's your reasoning in case of operation of an ambulance? Or
with the emergency lights on, you've got the emergency lights on. That's it. That's enough.
I think too, Josh. I think, I've seen a lot of that's happened where a patient might die in the ambulance. A lot of times, the chart gets looked at a little closer to see if anybody did anything wrong, and you know, there is that.
We are
a little bit more scrutiny.
Use the term sentinel event. But we should make things that go wrong in EMS much more closely scrutinized and not necessarily suspend people for things that, you know, it's inevitable that a lot of our patients are going to die. Small percentage, but large number once you add them all up.
Right.
We should evaluate every intubation. Anything that involves certain treatments, you know, pain management.
But your value system, for one, is, well, listen, there's a lot of things that can cause death in this, and, you know, the patient's stability could be one of them. So let's not go full steam ahead and blame the provider from the get-go, whereas when it comes to and ambulance operations, I admit straight up, might not have been the best example here, but to use it, you're saying from the get-go, you're guilty until proven innocent. So I'm not sure
when
why.
When you're using the lights and sirens and you get into an accident, yes. And sometimes the evidence to clear
the driver
is very, it should be very easy to obtain, because the police will show up and will investigate, and they will find out, oh, it's obvious the driver
nowadays,
of the other vehicle blew a light or whatever.
Nowadays, a lot of ambulances have, you know,
black
you
boxes.
Know, yeah, they have.
Right.
Yeah, they
and
have computer
cameras.
Systems
okay.
on.
All right,
cameras.
Guys. So let me back off that. Let me retract from that and just say, where would there be a non-patient scenario where? But my feeling is that it doesn't really matter. Like I said, I was using the ambulance as an example, bad example, but there are other scenarios where things go wrong and we are the first ones called out. And I'm just wondering how
RSI.
We retract ourselves.
You know, where we use paralytics to intubate somebody. Not in Pennsylvania, although we do have Atomidate, but that's something where it is used commonly in places, and there are deaths due to the paralytic because we're not real good at airway management. I mean, that's one of the big problems with EMS.
Yeah, but that
we
happens
should
in the hospital,
treat
too.
Every... Yes. They should do the same thing. Yes,
you know,
but
that,
pointing at somebody else and saying they get away with it, therefore we should get away with it, is very bad management approach. It's not what we want to do. Just because somebody else screws up doesn't mean we should screw up.
Yeah, I know up by me, where we intubated a patient, there's a special sheet we have to give to the doctor that he has to fill out that says that the tube was good when we got to the hospital and title was good and all that good stuff. They get attached
to the waveform.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't hook up end title
it's just a separate tracking thing that they just another thing. Of course, we have it on the monitor and we have it, you know. Document that way, but they want to document it by, you know, X-ray and all that good stuff, and it's just another thing that they put in place, I guess, to either tracking it or to just confirm that we're doing it, you know, properly. So,
you know, when they first were
a good
rolling
study
out,
study that somebody could do would be to look at this and compare the patients who have good waveform printouts with those who did not and had to have the X-ray or whatever form of confirmation that they did in the hospital, and see if it ever picked up on anything that the waveform capnography did not, because
yeah.
I don't think it will. I have seen a false positive end-tidal CO2 reading where it told me the tube was in, and it wasn't. I ended up having to pull it because other assessment signs were showing
right.
me that it was wrong, but I had somebody who was doing so much mouth-to-mouth on the patient that I think his stomach was pure carbon dioxide, and that was the reason for it. I don't know.
That's an interesting case.
But it can
That's
happen.
Right. I guess I'm fishing around for where would the example be that, you know, we're being unfairly hung out to dry. And, you know, granted, I'm going from an article based on a guy who was absolutely doing something illegal, but, you know, the first thing that newspapers can grab hold on is connect that illegal activity to a major...
But that sells the paper that gets clicks, you know, through on a website when people see that, you know. So that's what it's all about. I mean, that's what a lot of it, is about. I mean, even, you know, pretty much everything that you see online is they try to put a headline to get you to click through to the full article because, you know, there's so much information that they're trying to get your 30 seconds, a minute or so attention, you know, to read it.
So, you're basically...
The other thing is, why do any of us pay attention to the major media? They screw everything up, both left wing and right wing, and in the middle, they all are very poorly educated at what we do. Look at any science story. They don't do a good job. There are a few people out there who do a great job, but they stand out because they're so much better than everybody else.
I've
only read a few good articles by mainstream media people about EMS.
Look, I have been on that bandwagon for years, Tim. I have said that time and time again, we own this because it's our responsibility to contact, you know, those people and let them know when they got it wrong. But why is it important? And this is something that I have also said, because in the end, it's the communities that hold the purse strings. And if the communities look at us in one direction and misunderstand us, we won't get the funds we need that will allow us to properly operate. And even today, we're not getting the funds we need to properly operate. You know, it's an accepted standard.
The way we're funded
that EMS,
is all messed up.
What? Yeah, but yes, that's true. But the accepted standard on how we're funded, I mean, think about it. It's accepted that EMS get paid less than fire or PD. Why? Why is it accepted that that there's a hierarchy in that? Do you think that's the real cause, Jim?
I think that's part of it. I think, you know, you've got enough people looking that are willing to do it for free. So when they have to pay, they pay as little as possible.
But there are firemen who do it for free. You know, I mean...
Yeah, but I think in a lot of those cases, you know, a lot of fire departments that have been around for a while, the big municipal departments who have big unions behind them that fight for proper increases and things like that, where we don't really have, you know, unions that are strict.
No, we don't have dedicated unions, for
right.
sure.
Unions. We're umbrellaed under fire unions a lot of times, and that
or
can help
look how long we've been around.
But at some point, Tim, we got to get past the thing that I think that thought process of, well, we're so young, it's such a young industry, such a young profession. I mean, you know, at some point that's not paying the bills.
You know, there's a real
it depends where you are. There are some unions that are powerful. Most of the unions are somewhat fractured. While you have one main firefighters union and one main police union. And in EMS, we don't like joining together with other people. We're even more fractured than fire and police in New York City, where they do not agree, to put it mildly.
Yeah, well, that's to put it mildly. So to the man who usually has, almost always has an opinion about why something is not working the way it is, what have you sort of come up with, Tim? Because I'm sort of interested to know, I've heard myself speak on this enough. I'm sort of interested to know, in this problem that we know we've identified and we talked about this fractured system we work with across the country, are there any sort of kernels of wisdom that you sort of extrapolated that might be sort of an entry point to healing the wounds, fixing it?
Making what better? Treatment, pay, respect. What?
Our system. Take the 10,000 foot view, and just look at not only, you know, because I think in some respects you could make arguments that link. I can say that word link. Treatment, pay, respect, community standing. You know, resources. All of that can be linked together. You know, as one sort of issue of all of EMS.
If we were to be more open about what we do,
I think we would get more respect. Let people know why we're doing things. Educate people about what the best treatment is. Teach them a little bit of science so they can understand why certain treatments are good, why some should be avoided in certain situations, even though they may be good for the general situation, like nitroglycerin for chest pain. It is very effective for most heart attack patients, but if you have a right-sided MI, a right ventricular MI, you want to dump a bunch of fluid into them along with the nitro, or you want to withhold the nitro completely. These are things that people in EMS often do not know, and we need to show them evidence that things work or don't work, and make it so that people say, hey, show me why it works. If you can show somebody that something works, they're going to believe what you're telling them a lot more. If you tell them, oh, yeah, it works, just trust me, you'll get some people believing. But eventually they'll realize that, yeah, it doesn't work this way, it doesn't work that way. When you show them, you also generally explain the times when it doesn't work, why it doesn't apply to everyone. And very few things do apply to everyone.
Now listen, guy, why don't we end it there? We've only got about another 3-4 minutes, so I don't want to get too deep into all the stuff that we're fractured on, but we can go on for another, you know, day probably with that, you know. But Tim,
Tim,
I appreciate you. I appreciate you popping in and giving some great insight and some, you know, some good opinions on what we got talking about. We didn't get to all the topics tonight as usual, but that's fine. I think we did, you know.
Hey, Tim, you know, even though we get heated, buddy, you know, it's nothing but love. I have total respect for you. I mean that.
You too.
All right, so, Tim, I encourage everyone to go check out Tim's blog at roguemedic.com. Check out some of his blog posts there. And Tim, you still got the podcast going on at Standing Order, EMS?
Yes.
Standing Orders? All right. I know they had a problem with
the
site for a while.
Yeah, the link is on my sidebar.
All right. Yeah, I know there's a problem with the web domain or something for a while there, so I wasn't sure if you were live.
They've got it straightened out. The Standing Orders podcast, they're having to reload them by hand.
Oh, God.
And I'm not sure. Yes. So it's a bit involved, but mine, there are only two, and they're both up.
All right. The gerbils are running as fast as they can.
Well, go check out Tim's podcast and his commentary there as well at emsstandingorders.com. He said it's on the right sidebar, right, I believe?
Yeah,
you'll see it right there. You'll see Rogue Medic Rant sitting right there. You're not going to be able to miss it. Thanks to John in the chat room, along with, Festibits, or otherwise known as Pioneer Girl. She's switching
Festibits.
Things up on here, so.
What was with that, Pioneer Girl?
Yeah, I get a little confused there. So, all right, well, Tim, thanks for joining us. Maybe we'll see you next week.
Thanks for having me.
All right, have a good weekend.
Yeah, stay safe, bud.
You too. Happy Mother's Day, everyone.
Yeah. All right, Josh, that's it for us, I guess. We'll see you next week.
Cool. We flew today.
We'll have another exciting topic, I'm sure. Everyone, thanks for listening to EMS Office Hours. Be sure to tweet us at EMS Safe. Post comments here at the blog at Blog Talk Radio and over on the main site at EMSOfficeHours.com. We want to hear what you think about these shows and even suggestions for topics on upcoming shows as well, and we'd love to create a show based on something that you might suggest. So send it over to me. My email address is jhoffman@ems-safety.com. Until next week, as always, guys, Jim Hoffman, Josh Knapp, EMS Office Hours. Stay safe. We'll be right back.